Fightful.com.
White supremacy and Negro subordination. Part 21. North and South. Origin of the American idea of government. Although the progenitors of our so-called slaves were mainly imported at northern ports, and all of the northern and middle states have had at times considerable Negro populations, the process of transition southwards has been so rapid that the northern communities, or the people of the northern states, have been but little impressed by them, or influenced in their ideas and mental habits by the presence of this widely different and subordinate element of our general population. But when they became a fixed population, when Virginia, especially, had acquired what by comparison may be called a large Negro element, then the actual presence of these Negroes called into existence new ideas and gave development to new modes of thought or mental habitudes. All our ideas and mental habits are, in a sense, accidental, the result of circumstance, just as language, which is the outward expression of our ideas, becomes changed by time and circumstance. The English of the 10th century were widely different, of course, in their ideas and mental habits from the English of the 14th century, under the rule of the Normans, and this difference was widely varied from anything that mere time or ordinary circumstances could have produced. And the different mental habits of the people of America generally, when contrasted with those of Europe, show sufficiently that all our ideas are accidental, the result of local circumstance, though, of course, all are in subordination to those fixed and fundamental laws of mind that are specific with the race. The presence, therefore, of the Negro, of a widely different and subordinate element of the population of Virginia and other states, when it became stationary and had to be provided for by the local legislatures, its specific wants as well as those of the citizenship looked after, and its social adaptations rendered harmonious with the welfare of the former, naturally developed new ideas of government and new modes of thought in the dominant and governing race. Except, possibly, some of the Spanish colonies south of us, there was no portion of the New World where so many of those who could claim connection with European aristocracy originally settled as in the province of Virginia. In the earlier days of Massachusetts, a great number of the most respectable of the middle classes of English society, and some few instances of the old hereditary nobility, found new homes in the colony, but in the latter case, they had abandoned the old Norman traditions, and to enjoy their religion and freedom of conscience, identified themselves with Puritanism. In the Dutch province of New York, there was, perhaps, a somewhat larger infusion of the aristocratic element, but as Holland itself was essentially republican, and the Dutch really the originators of modern liberty in Europe, and moreover, had a very limited landed aristocracy compared with England and France, but few persons identified by tradition and association with the hereditary aristocracy of the Old World found their way into the Dutch settlements of the New. But Virginia was originally settled to a very large extent by the offspring of the old Norman chivalry, by the Cavaliers, the descendants of the proudest, most warlike, most chivalrous, heroic and enterprising, and at the same time, most tyrannical and oppressive aristocracy the world has ever seen. Those who belong to the race, the same species, of course, will under the same circumstances manifest the same qualities, and therefore, if at any time the child of a princely Plantagenet or lordly Warwick had been exchanged in its cradle, with the base progeny of some Saxon churl, who fed and kennelled with their hounds. The latter would have grown up with all the pride and chivalry and princely bravery common to the former. Nevertheless, a class, an aristocracy, a privileged order, forms sentiments and ideas, and transmits its traditions and rules to its descendants that may, for centuries perhaps, preserve their integrity. Even in our social everyday life and changing society, we often see families transmitting their family usages, habitudes, modes of thought, as well as action, for several generations, and with only slight departures from the family model left by some original or venerated ancestor. Aristocracies, however, usually destroy themselves by the very means they resort to preserve their ascendancy over the great body of the people, in order to preserve the respect, the awe, the continued belief of the vulgar mass in their seeming superiority. They must avoid the populace and intermarry with their order, and the more completely this is done, the more they become a close corporation, as it were, and violate the laws of consanguinity, the more rapidly they are deteriorated and fall below the general average of the people. The Northmen, the robust and enterprising fishermen of the Baltic, the filibusters and pirates of the northern seas, invaded France and conquered Normandy, and Rolla and his roving horde of followers threatened to overrun Paris, and indeed the whole kingdom. They finally settled down in Normandy, from which, at a later date, they emerged into Italy, conquered Naples, the island of Sicily, and for a long time threatened an invasion of the Oriental world, which could hardly have resisted such an indomitable race of men. A duke, a bastard duke of Normandy, at that time, laid claim to the crown of England, and with 40,000 followers landed in that country, and in a single battle so completely demolished the Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Saxonism, so much boasted of in these days, that the former have remained slaves ever since, and the latter were so utterly annihilated that it disappeared for ever on that fatal day at Hastings. Then, for the first time, the Normans assumed the distinct form of an aristocracy or privileged order. Though they had long since cast off the rude habits and uncouth manners of adventurers and conquerors, and when they invaded England were perhaps as intelligent and refined as any similar number of European people, and a great deal more so than those they conquered in England, they had never assumed the form, enacted laws, or established rules and regulations as an aristocracy or governing class. From this time forth, however, the Norman aristocracy ruled England with an iron hand, and though the Wars of the Roses, and the still more fatal conflict with the Puritans, or middle class, exterminated or drove out the remains of the Norman blood, and there is little, if any, in England at this time, the country is still governed by the traditions, the habits, in short, the system, established by the old Norman aristocracy. Most of the great families became extinct, while the younger sons and others of broken fortunes emigrated to Virginia, and with the establishment of the Commonwealth, very many of the Norman ancestry abandoned England. So many and so strong were the remnants of the old Norman families in Virginia that they refused to recognize the Commonwealth and actually set at defiance the formidable power and iron will of Cromwell. But these remains of the old Norman aristocracy, that aristocracy which for several centuries governed England, that have left their impress, their habits, their laws of primogeniture, their feudalistic customs, so deeply engraven on the English mind that the aristocracy of the day, though entirely modern, and with scarcely any family connection with it, are able to govern the masses through these habitudes as absolutely as the Normans once did by the sword and the strong hand of arbitrary power, These descendants of the old Norman race in Virginia have changed completely about, and though their ancestors were the main supporters of kingly despotism, they are the originators and champions of democracy in America. In all the changes and mutations of human society, there is scarcely any parallel to this change of ideas in Virginia, or to this extraordinary transformation which has changed the descendants of the old Norman aristocracy into the firmest and most reliable defenders of democracy. Of course, the early colonists of Virginia were of all classes and conditions of English society. Not a few of them, perhaps, were kidnapped young peasants, without friends or relatives to protect them, or to punish the base wretches who carried them over the sea and sold them here, as elsewhere in the American colonies. But it is undoubtedly true that a larger, vastly larger body of gentlemen emigrated to Virginia than to any other colony, and as these were all cadets or younger branches of the great houses in England, nearly all of which were Norman in descent, and nearly all of which, in the direct line afterwards, perished in the wars of the Commonwealth, it would seem equally certain that if there be any Norman blood anywhere, it must now be found, or mainly found, in Virginia. The cause of this transformation, this radical and extraordinary change of opinion, which has made the descendants of the proudest and most despotic aristocracy ever known, the authors and main supporters of democracy, must be a potent one, and as far removed from the ordinary causes, which in the progress of time modify men's opinions and habits, as the results themselves are extraordinary and without parallel. As has been remarked, all our ideas and mental habits are the result of circumstances, the external influences that surround us, the changed conditions of our existence, which give origin to new thoughts and new modes of mental action. And when we take these things into view and contemplate the changed conditions, the new and altogether different circumstances that surrounded these Virginia descendants of the cavaliers and gentlemen of England, then the causes are obvious. The new ideas that sprang up in men's minds, legitimate and consistent with the extraordinary and indeed unparalleled circumstances under which they lived. They were in juxtaposition with Negroes, with an inferior race, with widely different and subordinate social elements, and new thoughts, new ideas, as well as altogether different habits, naturally and necessarily followed. They saw these Negroes were different beings from themselves, not in colour alone, or in other physical characteristics, but in their mental qualities, their affections, their wants, in short, in their nature, and the necessities of their social life, their welfare and happiness, and indeed the welfare of this subordinate element, demanded corresponding action, with, of course, corresponding ideas and modes of thought. They saw that this Negro was not artificially or accidentally, but naturally different from themselves, that God himself had made him different and given him different faculties and different wants, and therefore designed him for a different purpose, and that it was an imperative and unavoidable duty, as well as necessity, to adapt their social habits and legal and political institutions to this state or condition of fixed and unalterable fact. But this was not all, nor the limit to the new ideas that thus originated in the changed conditions under which they were living. Their traditions, the mental habits of their old cavalier ancestry, the ideas they carried from the mother country, taught them to regard the person of a king as something quite sacred, and to whom an absolute and unquestioning obedience was always due, while the class of gentlemen, the nobility or aristocracy that more immediately surrounded royalty, was deemed to be altogether superior and different from the vulgar multitudes that made up the people. the celebrated formula of Archbishop Laud, that passive obedience and non-resistance was the absolute and universal duty of the people to the will of the king, expressed with brevity and accuracy the prevalent sentiment of the Cavaliers, and they demanded from their special retainers the same unquestioning submission which they themselves accorded to royalty. The ignorance of the great mass of the people on one hand, and the actual power and tyranny of the nobles on the other, sunk so deep into the common mind of England and other European people during the Middle Ages that though many generations have passed since, the sentiment of superiority in one class and of inferiority in the other remains yet, and in England as this day is nearly as potent as ever. But the descendants of the Cavaliers in Virginia were placed face to face with facts that utterly exploded these factitious sentiments that had their origin in a certain condition of society and not in nature or in the natural relations of men. They were in juxtaposition with Negroes, with different and subordinate beings, human, it is true, like themselves, but different human beings, just as pigeons, while birds equally with robins, are different birds, or as hounds, though dogs, were different dogs from spaniels or bulldogs. This was a great, starting, fixed fact that no amount or extent of sentiment, theory, or mental habit could explain away, or modify, or avoid in any respect. They saw this fact daily staring them in the face. They were compelled to recognize it, to legislate for it, or for these people, to adapt their social customs to it, in short, to conform to it, and therefore were forced to cast aside their preconceived notions, the traditions and mental habits of their ancestors, all their ideas of loyalty to a creature like themselves, and of their own class superiority, which they had brought from the old world. What was their fancied superiority over their own humbler brethren when contrasted with this natural inferiority of the Negro? It was the accident of education, of wealth, of refinement, of manners, or any other factitious, temporary, or accidental thing worth, which separated them from their less fortunate neighbours, when compared with the handiwork of nature, with the fixed and impassable barriers that separated them both from Negroes. What, in short, were the petty distinctions of human pride, vanity, and accident, in comparison with the ordinances of the Eternal? Such were the facts that confronted them. Such the external circumstances that developed new ideas and new modes of thought in the colonists of Virginia. Such the potent cause that changed the descendants of English Cavaliers into the earliest, most consistent, and most reliable champions of democracy in America. The same causes, to a certain extent, influenced the inhabitants of other colonies, and it will be found that in precise proportion to the amount and the fixedness of this Negro element in any locality, they were clear, corresponding views of liberty and equality among white men. Indeed, this is as true now as ever before, and almost invariably there are sound and rational views of liberty and of democratic institutions in precise proportion to the presence, or imperfect and unsound notions in proportion to the absence, of this Negro element. Those states like Mississippi, Texas, Arkansas, and Alabama that have relatively the largest Negro population are the most decidedly and consistently democratic, while Massachusetts and Vermont, with the fewest Negroes among them, are the most unsound in these respects, and however intelligent in regards to other things, are certainly behind most of the great American communities in political knowledge. South Carolina and perhaps some others, may seem exceptions to this very general truth, but if so, in reality, it is owing to peculiar causes, such as the education of many of its people abroad, in Europe and at the North. But even as regards that state, so exceptional, in many respects, land is more equally divided than in any other state, and where such a fact obtains, the general tendency to equality in citizenship must be strikingly manifested. The great revolutionary movement of 1776 gave full expression to the new modes of thought, the grand ideas, the glorious truths thus developed in the mind of Virginia, and relatively in the other colonies, where this cause, this Negro element, had anything like a stationary existence. It was no accident or chance that made Mr. Jefferson the author of the great idea, or rather the exponent of the idea embodied in the Declaration of Independence, the grand and immortal truth that all white men are created equal, and therefore entitled to equal rights, or as he expressed it, to life, liberty, and happiness. True, some other Virginian might have done this, and possibly some mind in the middle provinces, New Jersey or New York, might have formed a tolerably clear conception of this great fixed and unchangeable truth that underlies the whole superstructure of our political society, but no man in the northern provinces could have risen to this mental elevation at that period in our history. Indeed, comparatively few are even now capable of it. Massachusetts and the neighbouring colonies grasped the idea of independence with great clearness and urged it with an earnestness, bravery, and indomitable perseverance, certainly unsurpassed if equalled elsewhere, but it was independence of a foreign dominion and not independence of foreign ideas or of a hostile system. They were without Negroes, without any natural substratum in the social elements, without any test or standard to determine men's natural relations to each other, and clinging to the mental habits of their British ancestors, they were therefore incapable of forming those grand and truthful conceptions of equality which Mr. Jefferson and Virginians generally, under the influences that have been stated, so clearly apprehended. The accidental and artificial distinctions of society, family influence, wealth, education, etc., were, as in England, though of course not to the same extent, the standards, the tests, the landmarks of the political as well as the social order, and the phrase often used by New England writers of our own day, that representation was inseparable from taxation, fully expressed the mental habits and imperfect political conceptions of the northern mind. In England, except the titled aristocracy, the House of Lords, or peerage, which pretends to rest on blood or birth, wealth alone gives rights. The man is nowhere, no part or portion or element even of the political system. In every country where he happens to have property, he has a vote, but if without property, he has no voice whatever, and, as observed, is not even an element of representation, as are the Negroes of the South. Taxation and representation, therefore, are inseparable, so far as forms are concerned, in the British system, though as a fact, it is the working classes, who are not represented at all, that must pay all the taxes in the end. The mental habits of the North, in 1776, were fashioned on this model. They saw only those accidental things that separate classes in England, as wealth and education, and though they had an earnest desire for liberty, this liberty was a vague, undefined, shadowy sentiment, rather than any precise idea, resting on fact, as in Virginia. The immediate want and common impulse of independence, however, impelled all parties to act harmoniously for its accomplishment, and though the grand truths presented by Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence were far above the then intellectual standard of the North, it did not conflict with the mental habits of the Northern people sufficiently to interfere with the common object. But when that object was accomplished, when the foreign dominion was overthrown, and the common independence secured, and a new political system was to be created, then a conflict of ideas was developed that was found to be so grave that many good and patriotic men, for some time, feared it could not be compromised. The leading men of the North, the representative men, the men who desired independence from foreign domination, but with at best vague notions of liberty or of a new political system, Hamilton, Adams, and Morris, now came into serious conflict with the democratic ideas of Virginia. They desired a monarchy without a king, or a republic without the rule of the masses. The general notion was the British model, without its defects, or the British system, without its corruptions, and so entirely were some wedded to this that they declared it, with all its corruptions, the best government in the world. The leaders very generally assumed, as they often expressed it, that society was naturally divided into the few and the many, the educated minority, and the labouring majority, and as such was the actual social condition of the population, as well as the mental habits of the leaders. It is not at all surprising that they sought to found a government on such a basis. The agricultural population of the northern and middle states were then very ignorant indeed when compared with the present. Feudalism had not been long overthrown in England or Europe, and the serf transformed into the peasant. And though the American farmer of 1776 was a great advance over the latter, he still largely partook of that general apathy, stolidity, and ignorance which in all times until now, in our own favoured land, have distinguished the tillers of the soil. The large population at the North, otherwise employed, the mechanics, artisans, shopkeepers, and labourers, were generally, as in the mother country, without representation in the provincial legislatures, and as the interests of the educated classes, the capitalists, merchants, lawyers, and divines, were supposed to be, and were in fact in conflict with those of the former, they always desired strong governments to hold them in order. Indeed, the idea of mob ascendancy, of anarchy, the wild rule of the rabble, was the constant terror of the northern leaders, and in all the arguments of Hamilton and the Adamses, this was put prominently forward. Their rhetorical formula was always the same. The rule of the uneducated mass will degenerate into license and anarchy, from which the country can only be saved by the strong hand of some military chief, who first, a dictator, will finally don the purple, and the role so often played in the old world will be repeated in the new. This notion, and this reasoning, was legitimate, the consistent result of the social condition, as well as the offspring of the inherited traditions of the northern mind. The capitalists, all those who inherited wealth, the well-born and educated class, in short, the few who had the power in their hands, naturally sought to preserve it, and to build up a strong government, which, while it specially benefited themselves, should always be able to preserve order. That is, while founded on existing social distinctions, was sufficiently strong to repress the efforts of the multitude to change the social condition. They had no Negroes, no natural substratum in the social elements or natural distinctions of society. They had nothing before their eyes but the results of chance, of the accidents of life, nothing but wealth and education. Nothing, in short, but the debris of the old societies, those class distinctions which in the old world constitute the basis of the political and social order, and their mental habits, their opinions, their notions of government and its uses were, of course, in accord with these things, and their minds were incapable of rising above the existing condition, of overleaping the barriers and escaping from the external circumstances that surrounded them. There were, doubtless, individual exceptions, some men who were deeply imbued with the grand idea promulgated by Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. There were many in the Middle States who had an imperfect but advancing conception of this glorious truth, and there was still a larger number, perhaps, who were groping in darkness with a vague but earnest desire to embrace it. But the dominant thought, the prevalent opinion, the general mental habit, was reflected by the representative men, the great Northern leaders, Hamilton, Adams, Otis, and their companions, who desired to found a government on the British model, which, though it should be a great improvement over the former, was to be based on the same foundation. For, to their minds, their mental habits, there was no other, or at all events, no other safe, basis for government. They were honest and patriotic men, men of gifted minds and large attainments, men sorely tried and tested by the hardships and sufferings of a 7 years' war, through which they walked with their lives in their hands, and the scaffold always frowning on them in the distance, and the purity of intentions, the unselfish and patriotic desires of such men should never be questioned. They could not rise above the circumstances that surrounded them. They could not comprehend the grand idea of Mr. Jefferson. They saw before them only class distinctions, the rich and the poor, the educated few and the toiling many, and they desired to build the government on the status quo, and therefore demanded a strong government that should always be able to restrain the multitude and keep them in subjection to their rulers. On the contrary, as has been stated, Virginia had cast off the mental habits of the old world. The offspring had long since outgrown the traditions of their ancestors. The descendants of English cavaliers had changed entirely about in their opinions, and the children of those who held to the doctrine of passive obedience and non-resistance declared that resistance to tyrants was obedience to God. The cause, or the causes, of this wonderful transformation of opinion, this radical change in mental habitudes, which has made the descendants of the supporters of royalty, the originators and special champions of democracy in America, have been already considered. The presence of the Negro, the existence in their midst of a different race, was, and is, and always must be, a test that shows us the insignificance, and indeed nothingness, of those artificial distinctions which elsewhere govern the world and constitute the basis of the political as well as the social order.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.